I'm addressing more of my empathetic based concerns that are in relation to religion. And what I'm about to say is based off the shared empathetic concerns that people who have experienced church hurt and hurt by some people who are self-identified as Christian and predominantly in all the other religions have talked to me about. Some, you know, they're ex-Christians and people who have left the church but still believe in God. And then some of them are of all the other religions, and some of them are just secularists. Most of them are secularists, the ones I've interacted with who share the same empathetic based concerns that I share relating to religion. So before I read, I remember getting understandings of these subjects that I did not truly receive in church. So here we go. Nine Circles of Hell, Dante's Inferno. Inferno, the first part of Dante's Divine Comedy that inspired the latest Dan Brown's bestseller of the same title, described the poet's vision of hell. The story begins with the narrator, who is the poet himself, being lost in a dark wood where he's attacked by three beasts which he cannot escape. He is rescued by the Roman poet Virgil, who is sent by Beatrice, Dante's ideal woman. Together they begin their journey into the underworld, or the nine circles of hell. First circle, limbo. Dante's first circle of hell is resided by virtuous non-Christians and unbaptized pagans who are punished with eternity in an inferior form of heaven. They live in a castle with seven gates, which symbolize the seven virtues. Here, Dante sees many prominent people from classical antiquity, such as Homer, Socrates, Aristotle, Cicero, Hippocrates, and Julius Caesar. Second circle, lust. In the second circle of hell, Dante and his companion Virgil find people who are overcome by lust. They are punished by being blown violently back and forth by strong winds, preventing them from finding peace and rest. Strong winds symbolize the restlessness of a person who is led by the desire for fleshly pleasures. Again, Dante sees many notable people from history and mythology, including Cleopatra, Tristan, Helen of Troy, and others who were adulterers during their lifetime. Third circle, gluttony. When reaching the third circle of hell, Dante and Virgil find souls of gluttons who are overlooked by a warm monster, Cerberus. Sinners in this circle of hell are punished by being forced to lie in a vile slush that is produced by never-ending icy rain. The vile slush symbolizes personal degradation of one who overindulges in food, drink, and other worldly pleasures, while the inability to see others lying nearby represents the glutton's selfishness and coldness. Here, Dante speaks to a character called Siaco, who also tells him that the Guelphs, a faction supporting the Pope, will defeat and expel the Ghibellines, a faction supporting the Emperor to which Dante adhered, from Florence, which happened in 1302 before the poem was written after 1308. Fourth circle, greed. In the fourth circle of hell, Dante and Virgil see the souls of people who are punished for greed. They're divided into two groups, those who hoarded possessions and those who lavishly spent it jousting. They use great weights as a weapon, pushing it with their chests, which symbolizes their selfish drive for fortune during their lifetime. The two groups that are guarded by a character called Pluto probably the ancient Greek ruler of the underworld, are so occupied with their actions that the two poets don't try to speak to them. Here, Dante says to see many clergymen, including cardinals and popes. Fifth circle, anger. The fifth circle of hell is where the wrathful and sullen are punished for their sins. Transported on a boat by Feligius, Dante and Virgil see the furious fighting each other on the surface of the river Styx and the sullen gurgling beneath the surface of the water. Again, the punishment reflects the type of the sin committed during their lifetime. The punishment reflects the type of the sin committed during their lifetime. While passing through, the poets are approached by Filippo Argenti, a prominent Florentine politician who confiscated Dante's property after his expulsion from Florence. Sixth circle, heresy. When reaching the sixth circle of hell, Dante and Virgil see heretics who are condemned to eternity in flaming tombs. Here, Dante talks with a couple of Florentines, Farinata degli Uberti and Cavalcante de Cavalcanti, but he also sees other notable historical figures, including the ancient Greek philosopher Epicurus, Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II, and Pope Anastasius II. The latter, however, is, according to some modern scholars, condemned by Dante as a heretic by mistake. Instead, as some scholars argue, the poet probably meant the Byzantine Emperor Anastasius I. Seventh circle, violence. The seventh circle of hell is divided into three rings. The outer ring houses murderers and others who are violent to other people and property. Here, Dante sees Alexander the Great disputed, Dionysius I of Syracuse, Guy de Montfort, and many other notable historical mythological figures, such as the Centaurus, sank into a river of boiling blood and fire. In the middle ring, the poet sees suicides who have been turned into trees and bushes which are fed upon by harpies. But he also sees here profligates, chased and torn to pieces by dogs. In the inner ring are blasphemers and sodomites residing in a desert of burning sand and burning rain falling from the sky. Eighth circle, fraud. The eighth circle of hell is resided by the fraudulent. Dante and Virgil reach it on the back of Geryon, a flying monster with different natures, just like the fraudulent. This circle of hell is divided into 10 Bulgias, or stony ditches with bridges between them. In Bulgia 1, Dante sees panderers and seducer. In Bulgia 2, he finds flatterers. After crossing the bridge to Bulgia 3, he and Virgil see those who are guilty of simony. After crossing another bridge between the ditches to Bulgia 4, they find sorcerers and false prophets. In Bulgia 5, are housed corrupt politicians. Bulgia 6, are hypocrites. And in the remaining four ditches, Dante finds hypocrites, Bulgia 7, thieves, Bulgia 7, evil counselors and advisors, Bulgia 8, divisive individuals, Bulgia 9, and various falsifiers such as alchemists, perjurers, and counterfeits, Bulgia 10. Lastly, ninth circle, treachery. The last ninth circle of hell is divided into four rounds according to the seriousness of the sin. Though all residents are frozen in the icy lake, those who committed more severe sin are deep within the ice. Each of the four rounds is named after an individual who personifies the sin. Thus, round one is named Cana after Cain, who killed his brother Abel. Round two is named Antenora after Antenor of Troy, who was Priam's counselor during the Trojan War. Round three is named Ptolemaia after Ptolemy, son of Abibus. Son of Abibus, while round four is named Judeca after Judas Iscariot, the apostle who betrayed Jesus with a kiss. I don't believe in the nine circles of hell. And hell is not segregating at all. Next. American Christianity versus faithful Christianity. So American Christianity is Christless Christianity. And faithful Christianity is Christ-like Christianity. So I like faithful Christianity because it is Christ-like Christianity. I like both. I do not like American Christianity because it is Christless Christianity. All right? So again, Christless Christianity is American Christianity. I do not like both. Faithful Christianity, Christ-like Christianity. I like both. This is redletterchristians.com. I love Red Letter Christianity because it is faithful Christianity. Because Red Letter Christianity is also Christ-like Christianity. Here we go. Christ Ebling, March 21st, 2019, Immigrations, Refugees, LGBTQI+, Peace and Nonviolence, Politics, Theology, Women. Okay. I was flipping through my Facebook feed the other day when I happened upon Mary Colbert, a self-proclaimed Christian activist speaking on Jim Baker's TV show. In the clip, she stated that Donald Trump is the chosen one of God, and that if people come against the chosen one of God, you are bringing upon you and your children, your children's children, curses like you have never seen. Bullshit. Let me state that another way. If I oppose Donald Trump, God will curse me, my children, and my grandchildren. Fuck that. I've thought a lot about what Ms. Colbert said over the last 24 hours. I've come to realize that she represents the public face of what I've come to think of as American Christianity. Now, do not confuse American Christianity with Christianity in America. I am so in agreeance with the line. Now, do not confuse American Christianity with Christianity in America. Great. Agreed, 100%. Good. Christianity takes on many forms in this country. What I term American Christianity is a unique form of Christian expression that has come to the fore over the last 150 years, in which I assert has little to do with the basic tenets of what I'll call faithful Christianity. I strongly agree with that. The fundamental precepts of faithful Christianity are very simple and can be found in both the Old and New Testaments. An Old Testament example comes from the prophet Micah, chapter 6, verse 8. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Agreed. I say agreed because that is Christ-like Christianity. Jesus himself articulates the two most important characteristics of a Christian in Matthew chapter 26. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. This is the first and most important commandment. The second most important commandment is like this one. And it is love others as much as you love yourself. All the laws of Moses and the books of the prophets are based on these two commandments. To be a faithful Christian, all you have to do is love God, act justly, show mercy, and walk through life with humility. Pretty simple, right? Yes. I love faithful Christians. So how does American Christianity reflect these commandments? Perhaps the best way to understand the distinction is to use a literary technique from high school English literature. Let's compare and contrast American Christianity with faithful Christianity. Faithful Christianity seeks peace and reconciliation between individuals and nations. American Christianity espouses confrontation and preemptive war. Faithful Christianity turns the other cheek. American Christianity carries a gun. Faithful Christianity treats the foreigner among us with dignity and respect. American Christianity denigrates the foreigner and labels them criminals. Faithful Christianity offers forgiveness. American Christianity assigns blame. Faithful Christianity offers mercy. American Christianity seeks revenge and retribution. Faithful Christianity serves the needy among us. American Christianity builds $160 million temples to its ego across the street from homeless shelters. Faithful Christianity stands in awed silence at the birth of Christ. American Christianity turns Christ's birth into a multi-million dollar vaudeville show complete with singing, dancing, and a Santa sleigh suspended on cables from the roof of the sanctuary. Faithful Christianity frees itself from the material world in order to follow Christ. American Christianity fully embraces American consumerism. Faithful Christianity submits to the cross. American Christianity wraps itself in the flag. Faithful Christianity does not judge the lives of others. American Christianity condemns that which does not conform to its ideology. Again, faithful Christianity does not judge the lives of others. American Christianity condemns that which does not conform to its ideology. Faithful Christianity confronts the power structure in pursuit of justice. American Christianity wields power to oppress others. American Christianity is non-denominational in that it transcends Christian traditions. It cannot be called fundamentalist since it ignores the fundamental teachings of Christ. Let me read that again, that's powerful. American Christianity is non-denominational in that it transcends Christian traditions. It cannot be called fundamentalist since it ignores the fundamental teachings of Christ. I have seen Presbyterian churches that embrace American Christianity and Baptist churches that do not. American Christianity is a cancer consuming the vital organs of the body of Christ. Unfortunately, American Christianity is the public face of Christianity in this country today. Every day, Americans rarely see the faithful Christian serving meals at the Austin Street Shelter or the Bridge. They do not see faithful Christians providing free medical or legal services to the poor. They do not see the faithful Christians at the Vickery Meadow Learning Center teaching English to immigrants or helping them obtain citizenship. Instead, they see American Christians calling for the expulsion of immigrants and the banning of refugees. They see condemnation of women and homosexuals and calls to deprive them of their civil rights. They see the hatred of those who profess different faiths and calls to wage war against them, and to be inclusive of the entire LGBTQI+ community belonging. They see condemnation of LGBTQI+ people and calls to deprive them of their civil rights too. American Christianity is the antithesis of the teachings of Christ and the life to which faithful Christians are called. American Christianity is the religion of Constantine. It is the religion of Rome. It is the religion of empire. I must say that American Christianity is imperial Christianity. I dislike imperial Christianity anywhere and everywhere. I dislike colonial Christianity anywhere and everywhere. So every word in this Red Letters Christians article, I am in strong agreement with 100%. How Christianity was used to exploit Africans. Some of the missionaries worked hand in hand with the colonial administrators in advancing the subjugation of Africans, whether knowingly or unknowingly. This is the African Exponent, Friday, February 26, 2021, which is today. I'm reading it today, but this was by Takuzwa Hillary Shiwanza, September 13, 2017. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels were very sentimental about the role of religion and how it influences the way of thinking in people. They said that religion is an opium. It is an opium which drags people to accept poor conditions without complaining. When the Europeans came to colonize Africa, they did not just do that with the force they meted on Africans. Colonization was expedited by the use of religion, in particular Christianity. As of now, most Africans identify themselves as Christians and many as Muslims. It seems Christianity has done the most in affecting the conscience of the black person in Africa. African traditional religions have been washed away, especially with Christianity. They are viewed as pagan and heathen in nature. While everyone is entitled to their religion, it is the same religion which has shaped Africa's history, especially with the advent of imperialism and colonialism upon which it was built. Christianity achieved a major thing in Africa, to teach the black Africans to forsake all their traditions and to facilitate colonialism. The African was taught to abhor everything African and to accept a new way of life, a new way of living, a new order that alienated them from who they originally were. They were taught to accept these things. Christianity was subtly intertwined with the agenda of the West. They viewed Africans as backward, barbaric, and uncivilized. So the mission was to civilize the African, something which they achieved with a great degree of success. Christianity was the religion of the Westerners, and it is obvious the missionaries had Western values embedded in them. So what happened was a situation where the Africans were taught to hate everything African and to accept the European way of living. The early Christian missionaries worked hard, hand in hand with the colonizers. At most times, the missionaries were sent to negotiate treaties that would put the Africans under subjugation. The Bible followed the gun, and thus the influence of Christianity in the colonization process had a devastating effect on the Africans. The Christian values inculcated in Africans were to achieve certain objectives. One of these was to pacify the Africans so that they would become passive and docile while the Europeans did whatever they deemed necessary with the land of Africans. This is not to imply that Christianity is being vilified, not at all. As a matter of fact, it has become one of the most embraced religions on the continent and influences the way many think. The way it was during the colonial era is totally different from the way it is now. It is only the fact that when it came, it was used to exploit Africans. But now that everything has changed, so have the factors too. However, not all missionaries were bent on advancing the interests of the colonial masters. Some were of a genuine conviction, at least according to them, that the Africans really needed Jesus as their savior. Even though missionaries came with a good intention to evangelize Africa, the timing was bad. Missionaries came into Africa along with colonial administrators and traders with a plan to introduce Christianity, commerce, and civilization. Traders, T-R-A-D-E-R-S. Walter Rodney in his How Europe Underdeveloped Africa contended that missionaries were agents of imperialism. The Christian missionaries were as much part of the colonizing forces as were the explorers, traders, T-R-A-D-E-R-S, and soldiers. Missionaries were agents of colonialism in the practical sense, whether or not they saw themselves in that light. Rodney accused missionaries of preaching humility and submission in the face of gross injustice, inhumanity, and dehumanization. While British traders were exploiting their African customers, the missionaries preached peace, forgiveness, and good neighborliness, which actually prevented genuine rebellion, self-preservation, and determination. Missionaries worked towards the preservation of the status quo and upholding of the master-servant relationship between Africans and Europeans. In light of this view, the assertion that missionaries aided colonization is justifiable. With how everything has changed nowadays, one can only look at history and wonder how this much-embraced religion was used to exploit the Africans through the colonization process. So, all I can say is there is a lot of imperial Christianity everywhere, in multiple continents, multiple islands, and the residues of the imperial Christianity are felt everywhere. So, yes, you do have Christianity having a lot of beauty in a lot of people's lives and a lot of other people's lives. The way that they treat the religion that they say they adopt, it tends to have them in shackles instead of moving around freely. So it depends on who you're speaking with about these matters. Let's see how much time I have. Okay, I got plenty. All right. So, five things that we can learn from the early church. The early church we read about in Acts is very different to what we imagine as a church today, but we can still learn from it, writes Glasgow Elms James Glass. The word church can paint all sorts of pictures in people's minds. It usually depends on their background or experience, and sometimes it's an image painted by the media. The church we meet in the book of Acts is one that is very different from many of the more contemporary pictures people have developed of the church. That's not to say it was perfect. The church that had Peter and John amongst its leaders was also the church of Ananias and Sapphira. I do want to say that the early church had the same hypocrisies that are going on right now in the modern church. The same shittiness in terms of unethical behavior happening in the early church, just like there are in the modern church. I'm just keeping it real. If you do your history, you know I'm right. It saw spectacular answers to prayer. It also saw two of its most significant leaders martyred. It was able to resolve disagreements between different ethnic groups, but unable to help Paul and Barnabas resolve their differences. However, there's no doubt that the picture we have of the church in the book of Acts is one that is compelling. So what was it like? Perhaps the clearest picture that we have of the church in action is found in Acts chapter 2, verses 42 through 47. One, strong traditions. Firstly, the church, born in the power of the Spirit on the day of Pentecost, kept its shape by devoting itself to particular practices. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. They committed themselves to what they call the Word of God. This value placed on the Word is found throughout Acts and the epistles. Fellowship was high on their agenda as well. The text seems to indicate that they were equally devoted to the apostles' teaching, fellowship, breaking of bread, and prayer. This church was a tight-knit community of dedicated followers of Christ. The strength of their fellowship is demonstrated in verses 44 to 45. No one was in need because they cared for each other. Undergirding this fellowship was Jesus' command to love one another. Years later, Paul would further develop this theme in his teaching about the body and spiritual gifts. And of course, the Apostle John would go on to emphasize and expound the key component of fellowship, love one another, especially in his first epistle. Breaking of bread was also one of the core practices of the early church. Instituted by Jesus before his death on the cross, the Lord's Supper was central to the life and worship of the early church. Verse 46 reveals that it was practiced in smaller groups and homes rather than as one church of 3,000 plus people. And of course, prayer was an important part of the mix. The church in Acts was a praying church. The Gospels and epistles are full of exhortations to pray. To the power of God. Everyone was filled with awe at the many signs and wonders performed by the apostles. The early church was not only birthed in the power of the Spirit's power was part of its ongoing experience. It was this power that enabled the church to impact people at a deep level. They were filled with awe, literally fear. The miraculous is a hallmark of the witness of the church throughout Acts and the epistles. Three, giving generously. Generosity is the third feature of life in the early church. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had a need. Part of this generosity finds its impetus in the depth of the fellowship that existed between the early Christians. These verses provided fascinating insight into the early church. There was a strong sense of community. The believers were together and had everything in common. At the same time, that depth of community did not extend to communal living. They still retained property. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had a need. The kind of sacrificial generosity described here features throughout Acts and the epistles. For unspeakable joy. Fourthly, the church was joyful both in worship and fellowship. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people, Acts chapter 2, verses 45 through 46. A party might seem too irreligious to describe life in the early church. However, these verses describe a very happy bunch of people who clearly enjoyed being together worshiping God. If you are uncomfortable with parties, then think joyful. Meetings in the early church were joyful occasions. This kind of joyful fellowship and worship is found all over the New Testament. Paul's letter to the Philippians in particular is bursting with joy, even though he was in prison when he wrote it. 5. Reaching the lost. Finally, the early church was an evangelistic church, and the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. The church was evangelistic and reached out to the lost world. Notice how Luke describes the evangelistic witness of the church. Firstly, it was Jesus who was working through his church. Secondly, people were being saved on a daily basis. Thirdly, those being saved were added to their number. Evangelism was only complete when the new believers were added to the church. This picture of the church found in Acts chapter 2, verses 42 through 47 is not a complete picture. The church was still in its earliest days, and later decades, revelation from the Holy Spirit enabled church leaders like Peter, John, and Paul to develop and deepen the church's understanding of what the church is. Nevertheless, Acts chapter 2 introduces us to the broad themes and practices that shaped the church of the first century and have continued to shape the church and the church's most effective moments in history. This is written by James Glass, originally from Ireland. James is the pastor of Glasgow Elam Church. He took up that post in 2009. He was previously associate pastor at Reading Elam, moving from there to lead Elam Church Crawley. This is elam.org.uk. I don't like to call people the lost. I don't like to call people lost. Because I was told this quote. Well, actually, I heard this quote from one of the preachers that I've heard preach before. The same preacher said that healthy sheep make sheep. And what does that mean? It means that those who are already preaching about God. You don't have to be a preacher to preach, by the way. If you're already a Christian and you're in the congregation, it is your job to teach those who are not Christian and those who are coming back to Christianity, supposed to teach them, and I say them, not us versus them, but just them, the wills and the ways of Jesus. And in church, that same preacher who said these things said that we have relegated the role and the assignments of evangelism and the Great Commission to the pulpiteers, and many people subconsciously in the congregation think that's not their job to evangelize and to do the Great Commission, but that is not true at all. The shepherd doesn't make sheep. Sheep make sheep. That's what the preacher said. And that quote was very much amazing to even hear, because I've never seen a preacher be that that tough, loving, in a sense, to the congregation. I love this quote. It is by Joe Lufman. Can we stop using the terms non-believer and / or unbeliever to refer to non-Christians? People of different faiths and without faith have beliefs too. This is how language is used to support supremacy. Christian beliefs aren't the only acceptable beliefs. I am in 100% agreement with Joe Lufman. Because of what she just said, I'm going to stop right now using the terms non-believer and / unbeliever to refer to non-Christians. Thank you, Joe Lehman, for your constructive criticism that has helped me. So now that I have the understanding and now that I know better, I get to do better. Yay! So I think the early church is better than the modern church, and here's why. Because what I've seen in the early church, they had a complete separation of church and state. No military, no police, not into government. They were involved in the world in a sense that they chose not to be in positions where they knew they would have a hard time compromising their values. So they said, we're not going to put ourselves in a position where we're not going to compromise the values. So they would basically deal with the world's issues by just being about community empowerment. They figured we can resolve the world's issues, but we don't have to be in military, police, or government to do that. And from what I learned, anybody who was a Christian at the time and they were trying to be a part of military, police, and government, or, you know, were in those positions, the church leaders would basically ask them to resign and to quit because they didn't want to go through the headache of, we have our principles, but if we serve the government and military police, we might have to do things that go against our Christian conscience, as it's called. I really loved the early church. You know, I would love to be Christian with the early church. I mean, I dislike the modern church. I like the early church. Now, don't get me wrong. I like mature Christians from both the modern church and the early church. Mature Christians remind me of the early Christians. So those are the ones I like. And the only people in church I like, the ones who aren't trying to be milk Christians forever, the ones who are mature. Those are the ones I really appreciate. So that's all I want to say. I wish that all the five things that we can learn from early church, I wish I saw those things much more often, because the five things that was only experienced at its peak, at its highest in the early church. Modern church is imperial and colonial as Christianity, while the early church is faithful and Christ-like as Christianity. Modern church is Christless, while true Christianity that I'm seeing in early church and some people in our time, they are Christ-like Christianity to me. Okay, I want to go over this. So, reasons why I reject sin nature. Hate is natural at birth. That means that love is unnatural at birth. Depression is natural at birth. Joy is unnatural at birth. Chaos is natural at birth. Peace is unnatural at birth. Impatience is natural at birth. Patience is unnatural at birth. Disrespect is natural at birth. Kindness is unnatural at birth. Disloyalty is natural at birth. Faithfulness is unnatural at birth. Wickedness is natural at birth. Goodness is unnatural at birth. I said faith was unnatural at birth. Okay. When I say birth, human birth. Just think human birth. Okay. Roughness is natural at birth. Gentleness is unnatural at birth. Recklessness is natural at birth. Self-control is unnatural at birth. Hopelessness is natural at birth. Hope is unnatural at birth. Selfishness is natural at birth. Charity is unnatural at birth. Sexual evil is natural at birth. Chastity is unnatural at birth. Arrogance is natural at birth. Modesty is unnatural at birth. Okay, so let me go over them again. So love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, faithfulness, goodness, gentleness, self-control, hope, charity, chastity are all considered unnatural at human birth, while hate, depression, chaos, impatience, disrespect, disloyalty, wickedness, roughness, recklessness, hopelessness, selfishness, and sexual evil are considered natural at human birth. So let me finish this. Let me make this real easy. Truthfulness, sharing, upholding life, love, again, happiness for others, harmony, generosity, empathy, social drinking, fidelity, being trustworthy, homosexuality, excitement, purity, wisdom, sanity, diligence, carefulness, politeness, cohabitation, being a child of Satan, fucking up and bullshitting. Wait a minute. Let me read that one more time, so I don't want to get us confused. Being a child of Satan, cohabitation, politeness, carefulness, diligence, sanity, wisdom, purity, excitement, homosexuality, being trustworthy, fidelity, social drinking, empathy, generosity, harmony, happiness for others, love again, upholding life, sharing, and truthfulness are all considered unnatural at human birth. While ungodliness and unholiness, heterosexist marital living, conniving, carelessness, laziness, craziness, stupidity, impurity, anger, heteronormativity, cheating, adultery, drunkenness, hatred, envy, discord, jealousy, lust, murder, greed, and lying are all considered natural at human birth. Modesty is unnatural at human birth, but arrogance is natural at human birth. Fucking up and bullshitting is natural at human birth, while wholeness is unnatural at human birth. Let me go through this one more time. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, faithfulness, goodness, gentleness, self-control, hope, charity, chastity, modesty, truthfulness, sharing, upholding life, love again, happiness, harmony, generosity, empathy, social drinking, fidelity, being trustworthy, homosexuality, excitement, purity, wisdom, sanity, diligence, carefulness, politeness, cohabitation, and being a child of Satan are all considered unnatural human birth, while hate, depression, chaos, impatience, disrespect, disloyalty, wickedness, roughness, recklessness, hopelessness, selfishness, sexual evil, arrogance, lying, greed, murder, lust, jealousy, discord, envy, hatred, drunkenness, adultery, cheating, heteronormativity, anger, impurity, stupidity, craziness, laziness, carelessness, conniving, heterosexist, marital, living together, ungodliness and holiness are all natural at human birth. Fucking up and bullshitting is natural at human birth, and wholeness is unnatural at human birth. Those are reasons why I reject sin nature. I reject the sin nature belief. And there's more. So human beings at birth are considered evil, destructive, easy to ignite, difficult to stifle, self-centered, oppressive and possessive, decadent, sinful, and deadly. And we're considered to have wrong desires at birth. While at birth, at human birth, good, productive, difficult to ignite, easy to stifle, self-giving, liberating and nurturing, uplifting, holy and abundant life are considered unnatural at human birth. And lastly, fairness, justness, fair play, fair-mindedness, equity, equitableness, even-handedness, egalitarianism, impartiality, impartialness, lack of bias, objectivity, neutrality, disinterestedness, lack of prejudice, open-mindedness, nonpartisanship, I say bipartisanship too, honor, uprightness, decency, integrity, probity, probity, honesty, righteousness, ethics, morals, morality, virtue, principle, right-mindedness, propriety, scrupulousness, trustworthiness, and incorruptibility are all considered unnatural at human birth. So just behavior treatment is considered unnatural at human birth too, because justice is considered unnatural at human birth also. Wow. Lack of fairness or justice, injustice, an unjust act or occurrence, unfairness, injustice, inequity, corruption, cruelty, brutality, tyranny, despotism, repression, suppression, exploitation, bias, prejudice, bigotry, favoritism, partiality, one-sidedness, discrimination, partisanship, intolerance, wrong, injury, offense, unjust act, evil, villainy, crime, sin, inequity, misdeed, outrage, atrocity, scandal, disgrace, monstrosity, affront, and grievance are all considered natural human birth. That is why, as a Unitarian Universalist that I am, we are not original sin. We are original blessings. We don't believe in original sin. We believe in original blessings that we are. I'm an original blessing. I am not born in sin, and I am not shaped in iniquity. I am born in grace and shaped in humility. I'm an original blessing. I do not have a sin nature. I'm not sin stained. I don't need to be cleansed and purified. I need to develop in my completeness and maturity. I need to blossom in my wholeness. That is how I feel about me. And I'll read this lastly. The philosophy of colonialism, civilization, Christianity, and commerce. This is extremely short. Overview. As the imperial powers of Europe set their sights on a new geographic regions to expand their spheres of influence in the 19th century, Africa emerges a prime location for colonization due to its wealth of natural resources and purportedly undeveloped economies ripe for exploitation. In reality, European colonization devastated traditional African societies and economies. However, the leaders spearheading the movement cited the white man's burden, a term popularizing Rudyard Kipling's poem to morally justify imperialist expansion. The philosophy underpinning the white man's burden consisted of the three C's of colonialism, civilization, Christianity, and commerce. Civilization. In 1884, the Berlin Conference marked the official beginning of colonialism in Africa. One of the justifying principles behind colonialism was the need to civilize purportedly backward peoples of Africa. 15 years following the Berlin Conference, the supposed imperative of civilizing non-whites was expressed in Rudyard Kipling's poem published in 1889 in McClure magazine titled White Man's Burden. To seek another's profit and work another's gain, take up the white man's burden and reap his old reward. The blame of those ye better, the hate of those ye guard, the cry of hosts ye humor. Ah, slowly to the light, why brought ye us from bondage, our loved Egyptian night? The idea of the white man's burden was to better seek another's profit and ostensibly backward people, anyone who is not white. The lines following this initial declaration reveal the prevailing attitude in regards to how such a civilizing mission would proceed. Kipling bemoans that the African people would come slowly to the light and would lament their release from bondage. In essence, Kipling believed that these non-white racial groups were so backward that they would be unable to comprehend the benefits of Europeanization. It was Kipling's belief that Africans must be pulled toward the light in order to see the error of their, in his view, savage nature. The sentiments expressed in white man's burden were not uncommon during this time. Africans were considered culturally inferior, an idea that was supported by scientific racism. According to a lecture given in the USA, 35 years before the official start of colonialism, the so-called inferiority of Africans was evident in the deep-rooted intellectual and physical differences seen around us, and the white, red, and black races are too obvious and too important in their bearings to be longer overlooked. Not three. Quotation, the speaker, Dr. Knott, a medical doctor, goes on to assert that the black, white, and red races are categorically different from one another and could not possibly be related. Dr. Knott gave this lecture in the United States 35 years before the official beginning of colonialism. However, the same ideas, the same ideological belief in the inferiority of Africans and call toward a European view of civilization remained as white settlers began to claim swaths of Africa for their homeland's possession. Towards the end of his speech, Dr. Knott states that Africans are incapable of civilizing themselves. There Africa stands with her 50 millions of blacks, and there she has stood for the last 5,000 years. With this people occupying the same countries without one step toward civilizations and all the experiments in the United States, the West Indies, and have failed, not 19 through 20. Ultimately, these mentalities led to a violent, forceful takeover, Cochrane 230-231. However, prior to this, the idea existed that Europeans had a responsibility to colonize and therefore civilize Africans 12. The idea of civilization was the triumph and development of reason, not only in the constitutional, political, and administrative domains, but in the moral, religious, and intellectual spheres. The essence of French achievements compared to the uncivilized world of savages, slaves, and barbarians 14. In France, this idea was followed by a campaign to popularize ideas about Africans' lack of civilization through educational and media materials 13-14. Practically, this was carried out in the colonies through increasing infrastructure, public health campaigns, education, and political reform 38-39, 17-74. Those are pages that I'm being numeral about. Unfortunately, the eventual result of this was the use of coercive measures, including forced labor and violence that will ultimately cripple the continent 230-231. Okay, commerce. While European powers justified colonialism in Africa as a moral obligation to bestow modern civilization and Christianity on African societies, the potential for commerce and natural resources provided the true impetus for the colonization of Africa. Following the abolition of the British slave trade in 1807 and the decline of trade with the United States in the mid-1800s for the same reason, Africa represented to Europe a recently legitimized and untapped region for economic expansion, Lugard 69-75. To further compound the potential for aggressive competition, the Industrial Revolution and mechanization of European industries ignited an unprecedented demand for natural resources. The abundance of raw materials available in Africa, such as rubber, minerals, and oil, thus emerged as a viable solution to fuel the burgeoning industry of European factories. This amalgamation of factors drove Europe into a race to claim territory and obtain raw materials in what became known as the Scramble for Africa, Gain and Dugan. While European and African merchants have established trade partnerships prior to colonialism, European trade companies, often funded by colonial governments, served as the initial primary agents for economic expansion. The untapped wealth of natural resources provided the incentive for these trade companies to aggressively establish economic control over African territories. These first attempts at establishing control were met with mixed success, but the individuals, upon their return to Europe, effectively employed nationalistic rhetoric to lobby for increased government support. Upon being expelled from the Ugandan kingdom of Bunairo, the British explorer published The Rise of Our East African Empire, in which he justifies the colonization of Africa as an imperialistic and economic obligation. It is sufficient to reiterate here that as long as our policy is one of free trade, we are compelled to seek new markets, to allow other nations to develop new fields, and to refuse to do so ourselves is to go backward. We owe to the instincts of colonial expansion of our ancestors those vast and noble dependencies which are our pride and the outlets of our trade today, and we are accountable to posterity the opportunities which now present themselves of extending the sphere of our industrial enterprise are not neglected, Lugard 69-75. The lobbying efforts and publications of memoirs successfully garnered national support for the establishment of colonies. Another equally important economic incentive drove the effort of colonial expansion. As the volume of factory goods skyrocketed with the development of industrialization, European demand cannot match the rapid rate of production. Author Jules Ferry states, the policy of colonial expansion is seen from the perspective of a need felt more and more urgently by the industrialized population of Europe, and especially the people of our rich and hardworking country, France, the need for outlets for experts. Ferry's speech before the French Chamber of Deputies. European powers responded by flooding the African colonies with European exported goods to match the volume of production. As a result, the domestic African industries were driven out of competition, gaining dugong. While the administrative policies varied between the different colonies, the systems of traditional African economies were completely uprooted and exploited by colonialism. In its most extreme form, such as the case of the Congo under the Belgian rule of King Leopold, the European powers erected extractive states. In this notorious example, the population was stripped of all private property and forced into labor with the sole purpose of extracting and supplying as much of the colony's resources as possible to the colonizer. In addition to disrupting traditional African industries and forms of agriculture, the Europeans did little to foster the development of trade between African states. This exploitation produced far-reaching consequences, as African societies often remained economically dependent states long after their independence, as Acemoglu, Simon, and Robinson, right? So, oh, okay, I can wrap up with this one. Okay, I'm going to really read. Christianity was once justification that European powers used to colonize and exploit Africa. Through the dissemination of Christ's doctrine, European nations such as Great Britain, France, and Netherlands sought to educate and reform African culture. In his book, A History of Africa, scholar J.D. Fetch describes the racially based logic of European intellectuals, missionaries, saying mid and late 19th century Europeans were generally convinced that their Christian scientific industrial society was intrinsically far superior to anything that Africa had produced. Page 322. Familiar with the diverse cultures on the continent of Africa, European explorers viewed practices unfamiliar to them as lesser and savage. To many European nations, Christianity represented Western civilization and the basis for Anglo-Saxon morality. Christianity served as a major force in the partition and eventual colonization of Africa, Bohan 12. During the late 19th century, European nations increasingly vied for global power. In an attempt to augment political and regional influence, nations like Great Britain and France needed a justification for expansion. Essentially, Christianity was the guise which Western governments justified the exploitation and conquest of African nations. In the poem The White Man's Burden, poet Rudyard Kipling exclaims, take up the white man's burden, the savage wars of peace, fill full the mouth of famine and bid the sickness cease. Originally denoted as a reference to United States imperialism in the Philippines, the Anglo-centric basis of the poem holds true to the root structure of imperialist ideology. Denouncing the religious practices of Africans as witchcraft and heathenism, European nations sought to convert and then exploit the indigenous peoples of Africa. In Kipling's poem, the lines, your new caught sullen peoples, half devil, half child, refer to the European belief that Africans were heathens resigned to live a life of savagery. Furthermore, European missionaries called upon the tenets of Christianity to spread what they believed was a just and compassionate doctrine. In practice, they were used to degrade the culture and society of the African people. Under the pretense of humanitarian theology, European powers strategically implemented Christianity as a divisive imperialistic tool. In a missionary memoir written by monk named Daniel Cumler Flickinger describes the state of African culture, religion, society, and nation of Ethiopia. In a chapter entitled Evangelization Difficulties, Flickinger states, the only reason why our theological views are not as foolish and corrupting as theirs, the Ethiopians, that we are not believers in witchcraft, devil worship, and a thousand other foolish things, is simply because the light of heaven shines upon us. 84. Flickinger articulates an argument used by Christian missionaries to justify the exploitative and coercive tactics implemented by Europeans. Fuck you, Rudyard Kipling. Fuck you, Daniel Cumler Flickinger. And fuck you to all the racists who claim to be Christian. Fuck all of you shit cracks, ass cracks, fuck you, go to hell, and kiss my ass. You shit stains in your goddamn drawers. And lastly, before I conclude, I must say this. To all the sympathizers of the racists that are part of Christian history, I have two words for you. Fuck you.